From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll look at the rising cost of rent in Milwaukee and what it means for residents. Then, the filmmakers behind the Loyola Project share the cultural impact of the 1963 Ramblers team beyond the game of basketball.
They had their lives on the court, and they were spectacular. But they also had their lives off the court. And off the court, they lived two different realities. There was a white college athlete reality, and there was a black college athlete reality.
We'll give you a roundup of this summer's many festivals and events, plus tell you about a rare four-toed salamander that was discovered by a UW-Milwaukee student.
They're not common to be found above ground, let alone October 28th.
In the fall, you really find them more in the spring.
Fall. It was very mind-boggling.
That is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. About half of Milwaukee County renters are rent burdened. That means they spend at least 30% of their income on rent. Rent prices are continuing to rise in the Milwaukee area, while the state's minimum wage is just $7.25 an hour. Jaidi Cancel-Martinez is an associate scientist at the Center for Economic Development and works in the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. She joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to discuss what factors go into the rising cost of rent and how it'll affect quality of life for people in Milwaukee.
Generally, right now, what's going on with rent in Milwaukee and why is it increasing and what is it increasing to?
So there are some multiple factors that goes in with the rising cost of rent. We also got to think about the rental vacancies. So before the pandemic, rental vacancies in the Milwaukee area was about 5%. So when we have rental vacancies between 4 and 6%, that it's an overall good for the market, good for the options. Once the pandemic hit and last year, we had close to historically low rental vacancies in the area. So those rental vacancies were between 1.5 to 3.4. So as we can see, that's under 4%. When we have low vacancies, that hints that there's a tightness in the market, right? So there's less supply for increased demand. So when that happens, then we can see a rising cost in rental units. For this type of data that I'm talking about is for rental listings. So if people are looking to rent a unit, they're going to see the prices going up. And overall, as of March, the average rent in the Milwaukee metro hovers around $1,300 and $1,500. And that, of course, varies, in terms of the size, in terms of the square footage, the number of bedrooms, and also the location. So, of course, rents in some neighborhoods might be higher compared to other neighborhoods.
Generally, how many bedrooms and what's the size of those apartments that you saw in the new listings to get to that average number?
So that depends on the data and the data source. So it varies by the data source. So if we look at Zillow, if we look at Rent Cafe and other private companies, it varies. But in overall, that's the price for a one-bedroom unit. For larger units, of course, the price is going to look a little bit higher. And again, it all depends also on the location as well.
And I'm just generally curious, too, how does rent for a one-bedroom unit compare to other nearby cities in southeast Wisconsin?
Compared to our neighboring Racine, city of Racine, the rent in the Milwaukee area is a little bit higher compared to Racine. But if we compare to Madison, then our rents are slightly lower, of course. So compared to other cities like the Twin Cities, Minneapolis, St. Paul area or Chicago area, the rents in the Milwaukee areas are also slightly lower. And of course, we try to compare to areas in Florida, which the markets right now are extremely hot. The rents are much lower than in Miami or Fort Lauderdale.
But you just mentioned that you compare the data to Miami or Fort Lauderdale. How does the Midwest compare to other parts of the United States?
So in terms of rental costs, it's lower compared to the Sunbelt cities. Also, in terms of popularity, Milwaukee, of course, smaller than other cities like Chicago or the Twin or Minneapolis and Paul. However, one thing I wanted to highlight is that places that were really popular, like that are really popular and the rental market is really expensive, like San Francisco, during the pandemic, the city there, the area saw an overall decrease in the rental price. However, lower cost areas like Milwaukee, they had an increase in the price. And the trend was also seen in other smaller cities. So interestingly, the pandemic had an effect in terms of the rental costs and rental prices and listings and overall across the nation.
What was the trends generally in Milwaukee before the pandemic? Were we going to be getting an increase in rent eventually?
Yes. So in 2019, overall, prices in the Milwaukee metro area, the rent, and this is according to U.S. Census data, was around $903. However, we look at other data sources, it looks like, of course, has increased over the past 2 years. But if we also try to adjust things with inflation, in overall, the change hasn't been as much. This is something also we got to keep in mind with calculating change and also the data sources. So in overall, I do not foresee or expect the cost of rent to increase enormously over the next months. Also, because the other factors are influencing this. For instance, the cost of living is also rising. So maybe people that were looking into find a new rental place, they might stay a little bit longer. Also, even though the rental vacancies are a little bit low, there might be some changes, you know, with people moving. So there might be units that become available. So if the supply increases a little bit, then that can meet some of the demand. So in overall, even though there's been some changes and some increases, I don't expect those to be exorbitant.
The minimum wage in Milwaukee is $7.25. And assuming that someone making minimum wage works 40 hours a week, 5 days a week, before taxes, that is only $1,160 a month, which a whole check isn't even close to the average monthly rent for a one-bedroom apartment in Milwaukee. How will this continual rent increase over time impact Milwaukeeans in the long run, and whose quality of life will be the most affected to those renting in the city?
That is a great question, and that is a great area of concern. Milwaukee residents have experienced what we call housing cost burden for quite a while. The percentage of rent burden household, that means household that spend more than 30% of their income on rent, the percentage has hovered around 50%, so roughly half of the Milwaukee households. So in Milwaukee County households spend over 30% of their income in rent. And that's been for over 10 years now. And even before the pandemic, the rent burden in the Milwaukee area was about half, about 50%. If we look, the city level is even higher. So 53% before the pandemic in 2019, 53% of renter households were spending over 30% of their income on rent. If we add on the cost of transportation, the cost of food, and other things that are necessities, basic necessities, yeah, that can put a lot of strain into individuals and families, especially those with low and moderate incomes. So definitely this is quite a concern.
With this general concern that has been around from what you just mentioned for the last like 10 years, from your perspective as an academic, what is needed to ensure that the quality of life of those who are rent burdened in this way have an increased quality of life?
When we talk about housing market, you know, that of course that impacts people. So we got to think about this question from the two sides. One is the cost of rent and all the things that go, you know, with the cost of housing. One thing families and individuals we can do is we try to budget as best as we can, right? However, right now, the unemployment rate is quite low. And overall, of course, it all varies, but it's quite low. But the wages, we got to do something about that. Of course, there have been some improvements recently, but wages haven't kept up with the rising cost of housing in the past years. So this is something, again, we gotta address the wage situation in our area to try to improve conditions for individuals and their families, and households in general, and also be cognizant when we are trying to look for a good home or a good rental unit out there and try to do their best budgeting. I talked about the rent burden. We try to calculate what is called the median renter household income and compare that to the median rent. And overall in the Milwaukee area, especially in the county and the city, there's been a mismatch for quite a while. So even before the pandemic, the median renter household income was about $33,000 a year. And that translates to $2,781 a month. So if a household spend a third of that for the rent, that it's about $834. So the household will be roughly $45 short to meet the median cost of rent in the area. And this is not new. Again, this is something that's been happening for a while. And that's, again, something I want to highlight with addressing wage or income situation that we have in our area, and also find ways to make housing more affordable. Also, there are resources out there, you know, for anyone who wants to get to know more how to get assistance. I learned about the Milwaukee Rental Housing Resource Center provides information there for both renters and property owners and property managers as well.
That is a lot to keep in mind as we see rent increasing in our area. And I really appreciate you being here today, Yadi, to talk about this topic.
Thank you.
Jaidi Cancel-Martinez is an associate scientist at the Center for Economic Development and works in the Department of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go, or if you'd like to hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll look at some of the many festivals returning to Milwaukee this summer. But first, we'll speak with the director and narrator of the documentary The Loyola Project. The film takes a closer look at the school's 1963 men's basketball team, one of the few integrated college basketball teams of its time. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you're a sports fan, you may have heard about the 1963 Loyola Ramblers men's basketball team and their historic NCAA championship win. But there's more to this team's story than that final game of the 62-63 season. The documentary The Loyola Project re-examines the impact of the 1963 Ramblers, whose national title run not only brought in a new era of equity in college basketball, but shaped the very style of how the game was played. Lucas Williamson is the co-writer and narrator of The Loyola Project, and Patrick Creedon is the documentary's director. They both join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of a free community screening at the Oriental Theater tomorrow night.
So, Lucas, you were a basketball player for Loyola and a co-captain, and you are the co-writer-narrator of this film. And I imagine learning about the Iron Five is kind of part of being on the Ramblers, no matter what year you're playing. But what made you examine this story differently and prompt the making of this documentary?
Yeah, you know, when I decided to, like, or when Patrick brought me onto the team, it wasn't a decision that I took lightly, simply because, as you said, you know, being a part of the team, you know, of the 63 team and like the things that they went through. So I was a bit hesitant to come on at first because like the story means a lot to me and I didn't want to be the one to mess it up. But, you know, I'm so grateful that I actually did and that I was a part of this, because I didn't know all the details of the story. Like, I had no idea about their New Orleans trip or like how they felt on campus. There were so many things that in the movie that I didn't know about. And I always like to say this story is a story that needs to be heard and needs to be told. So it's the fact that the opportunity presented itself and I got to be a part of it was, you know, truly a blessing. And I'm happy that I actually was brought on.
So Patrick, when did you become familiar with this story of the 63 team and what was it like to team up with Lucas?
I first heard about this story shortly after Loyola's 2018 Cinderella run to the Final Four. I think like a lot of people, this story just was not on my radar. And the irony is that Lucas and his teammates in 2018 really brought this story back to life. When you have a run like Loyola had in 2018, that becomes, it's not even just a national story, it's like an international story. And the further they advanced, the more people wrote about and talked about the history of the program. So suddenly the 1963 Ramblers was sort of, it came back to life. And I was one of those people that was, that learned about it for the first time, thanks to Lucas and his teammates. So in a way, that's another reason why it seemed like a really good choice to make Lucas our storyteller. He's not just the voice of the movie, he's also one of the writers of the story, because Lucas is, he's carrying the torch that those guys were carrying in 1963. And the story continues, and that's all sort of what you see in our film.
So for any listeners who are unfamiliar, can either of you explain the climate that these players had to live and play sports in, especially navigating playing college basketball in the North versus the South, where in some places Jim Crow is an unspoken law and in other places it's an explicit written law?
In 1963, there was an unwritten rule in college basketball that said that coaches could play three black players, but they could not play four. And everyone followed that unwritten rule. At the same time, Coach George Ireland of Loyola was fighting for his job. The students at Loyola were unhappy that the team had been losing. People in Chicago are competitive and they love their basketball and they wanted to have a good team at Loyola. What Coach Ireland realized was he needed to recruit new blood and he needed to put the best players on the court. And as a result of that, and again, as in an effort to keep his job, he ended up starting four black players in 1962 and 63. That's really the heart of our story. And that's, we get to really spend the season with those teammates and figure out how they did what they did.
What stood out to you both about the chemistry of this team, not just by looking back at game archives, but in speaking with the players for the documentary?
Yeah, I mean, I've had the pleasure of actually like meeting them and talking with them even before this movie became a thing. So, I mean, one thing that stands out to you is they had an interesting dynamic back then, an interesting relationship between the black and white players, meaning that, you know, the black players on the team, they were going through things that they simply just didn't talk about. And on the Zoom call that we had between, you know, myself, a few of my former teammates, and the 63 team, well, that was really the first time that they talked about this. And they had no idea that their fellow teammates were going through these types of things. Not to say that their chemistry was bad, because they won a national championship. So their chemistry was there. It's just, you know, just a different era. You went through things and you just didn't talk about it back then, or they were just simply understood as just the lay of the land. So it was so interesting to see, you know, their chemistry and their relationships versus today, versus, you know, we have social media, we have all these athletes today that are, you know, outspoken, that are doing work in the community, where it's almost seen as a good thing to go out and speak. But back then it was different in the 60s. So that was what stood out to me.
What is so striking is that for a team that had such amazing chemistry on the court, that chemistry went away when they walked off the court. The black players were dealing with racism in a major way every single day of their lives. And yet the team as a whole was not in sync as to what some of the players were going through, some of their teammates were going through. The way I think of it is that these young players, they really lived two lives. They had their lives on the court and they were spectacular, but they also had their lives off the court. And off the court, they lived two different realities. There was a white college athlete reality and there was a black college athlete reality. I hate to say it, of course, Lucas can speak to this more than I can, but I know for a fact that that exists at a certain level in a lot of colleges today. As the movie has traveled around the country and we've now screened it over 80 college campuses, there's a lot of athletes and there are a lot of coaches who have told me personally that this problem still exists. It's different, it's evolved, but it still exists.
Did you want to add to that, Lucas? How is being involved in this project and traveling to other campuses and talking with other fellow student athletes and students resonated with you?
Yeah, I mean, I can echo Patrick in saying that I've had, you know, a number of student athletes reach out to me through social media saying that they saw the film and that they had a strong reaction to it. And I mean, I think that that issue that Patrick is talking about is really translated, you know, in just as racism as a whole. You know, it's still a thing that we're dealing with today. It might not be, you know, as blatant as I like to call it, you know, in the 60s where you had, you know, lynchings, you had marchings, you had, you know, all these, you know, historical events, and you had Martin Luther King, you had Malcolm X, you had Rosa, all these leaders. But nowadays it's a little less blatant. It's little, you know, it's evolved. It takes on a different shape. It's systemic. Those are the types of conversations that are coming out of this movie. I don't know specifically when my teammates watched the movie, it's like, you know, we talked about it. It created a space in a safe setting for us to, you know, talk about sports, but then ease into those tougher conversations about, you know, the things they had to deal with on and off the court and how, you know, now we're so much more prideful to represent our university because we're in direct correlation with those guys. So those are the types of conversations that we hope that people start to have when they see the film.
The Loyola Project just shows how many factors this team was dealing with, all while trying to be the best athletes that they could in showing a historic season, of course. How do you want this film to add to the Loyola team legacy?
I would just put it this way. College sports is really big business. I mean, it's a $1 billion industry, to put it lightly. And because of that, there's a lot of schools and there are a lot of coaches that are less inclined to rock the boat, especially the big schools, especially the big brand names, you know. Schools like Loyola of Chicago play a really important role in the future of college sports because they're smaller, because they're more independent. And just like what they did in 1963 by breaking the unwritten rule and winning a national championship and basically changing the game of college basketball, they continue to be trailblazers. They currently have the youngest coach in Division I basketball. His name is Drew Valentine. He's about 30 years old. He might be 31 now. He's a young man of color, and he's Loyola's head basketball coach. Loyola continues to challenge conventions. They continue to take risks. And I think that that's the legacy of Loyola basketball. And I think that's the future of Loyola basketball.
For me, it's not, you know, how does this movie like improve the legacy of Loyola? It's more so just getting this story out there, getting more people to know this, get familiar with this story is what I believe the film does in a great way. Because, you know, the legacy of the 63 Ramblers, I mean, it is what it is. They did what they did. But as we started off, like, it was a story that was fading away into history. So I think just the more people know about it, the more people talk about it, that actually ends up improving the legacy. Because this is a story, like I said, that needs to be told and needs to be heard.
Well, Lucas and Patrick, I want to thank you both so much for telling this story in such a great way and for sharing more about it with me today.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thanks for having me.
Lucas Williamson is the co-writer and narrator of the Loyola Project. Patrick Creedon is the documentary's director, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. The film will have a free screening tomorrow night at the Oriental Theater, presented by Milwaukee Film and Northwestern Mutual. There will also be a post-screening discussion with Williamson, Creedon, and UWM Athletic Director Amanda Braun. You can find more information at wuwm.com. It seems that summer has finally returned to Milwaukee, and with it, there are a myriad of summer festivals. For the past couple of years, many organizations have been leery of having large gatherings due to the pandemic. Some festivals continued with extra precautions, while others canceled altogether. But this year, most of our favorite local festivals have returned. Milwaukee Record recently released its Summer Festival Guide, and co-founder Matt Wild joins me now to talk about it. Matt, as always, thank you for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me once again.
There is a lot to look forward to this summer. We're going to go through it month by month. There is, of course, some stuff that's happening this May, but I'd like to start with June because that's really when things heat up.
Absolutely. And, just before we even begin, it's been such a pleasure seeing all of these festivals and all of these music series and all of these beer gardens and on and on and on. It's been so wonderful to see them all pop up again. And after being gone for so long, for sometimes, for a full 2 years, it's great seeing everything, most everything pretty much back. So yes, it all begins in June. You've got things like Pride Fest. That, for me, is kind of like the unofficial beginning of like the big festival season. Pride Fest, of course, takes place on the Summerfest grounds, Henry Mayer Festival Park. That is June 2nd through the 4th, and that kind of kicks things off on the Summerfest grounds. And from there, it's just full force. Every other week, there's something there, whether it's Summerfest, of course, which this year we'll get to, is split over 3 different weekends. The cultural festivals that are all happening there, which are all back, all really except, I think, Festa Italiana won't be back this year, but most of them will be. So yeah, it's great to see kind of Pride Fest June 2nd through the 4th, kind of kicking things off down at the Summerfest grounds.
All right, so a lot that's happening this June. Of course, Pride Fest is a standard favorite here in Milwaukee. As we get into July, what are some of the big local festivals that are going to be returning?
Well, it's nice to see some of the fireworks celebrations returning, especially the city of Milwaukee. Lakefront fireworks are returning July 3rd. That's certainly a big one. But there are a lot of like smaller things that are kicking off in July. There's Bastille Days. That's coming back July 14th through the 17th. That was just announced recently. Bastille Days is going to be a little smaller this year than it had been in previous years. It's been off since the beginning of the pandemic. There was no Bastille Days in 2020 or 2021. So they'll be back this year with kind of a smaller budget. They won't have the giant Eiffel Tower that's being repaired, I believe, at this point. But they're still doing the Storm the Bastille run and all of that. So it's great to have that back down at Cathedral Square Park, July 14th through the 17th. Speaking of Cathedral Square Park, Jazz in the Park is back this year for the first time in 2 years. That is on Thursday nights, beginning July 21st and going through September 29th. That Jazz in the Park, my gosh, has been going on for, 25, 30 years at this point. It is just kind of a long-standing Milwaukee summer staple. And there's some big things that are returning as well. The Milwaukee Air and Water Show is coming back to the Milwaukee Lakefront and Milwaukee Skies July 23rd and 24th. So if you are a big fan of that, you have that to look forward to. If you have pets, hide your pets for those days because at least my pets, my cat, does not enjoy the Air and Water Show. But I know a lot of folks do. So that's coming back. And then you have things like the River West 24. That's coming back in full force. It was sort of back last year, but it's great to see it again this year. That's July 29th and the 30th. And that weekend in July, kind of weekend in July is just slam-packed with stuff as always. There's the River West 24. German Fest is July 29th through the 31st down at the Summerfest grounds. Brady Street Festival is July 30th. Milwaukee Brew Fest in McKinley Park, that's July 30th. And even, you know, you have these smaller kind of little block parties. Puddler's Hall, great little bar in Bayview. They're having a rock party, block party, also on July 30th. So it's always that last weekend of July when there's just about 8,000 things going on. And like I said before, it is wonderful to see that.
It promises to be really packed at the end of July. And as we get into what some consider the dog days of summer, as we get into August, there are yet again really a lot of different festivals, events that you can go to, I guess, celebrate the end of the summer, but certainly celebrate the last kind of moments that you can where people have time off.
Absolutely. And the month of August kicks off with a big one, the Wisconsin State Fair at the Wisconsin State Fair Park. That is August 4th through the 14th. The State Fair was back last year, I believe, but did not happen in 2020. State Fair is just this wonderful, delightful, weird, wild, great thing where you can get stuff on a stick, see live music, see some lumberjacks, and see some dogs jumping in water, and, you know, also, like, renew your hunting and fishing license all at the same time. The State Fair has it all. Always a big fan of that. And check out a lot of livestock as well. And who doesn't love to do that? August 6th, you have the Black Arts Festival at Henry Mayer Festival Park. That's returning this year. And you have a bunch of other smaller festivals, too. Center Street Days Festival, which, of course, takes place on Center Street. That is returning August 13th. You've got cultural festivals like Irish Fest. That is back August 18th through the 21st. And just on and on and on. There's a Bloody Mary Festival at Pfizer Forum Plaza, the Deer District out there. You've got Mexican Fiesta. That's back at the end of August, August 26th through 28th. Milwaukee Oktoberfest, don't forget about that. That is also August 26th through the 28th. That's at the War Memorial Center downtown. Like you said, it is kind of the dog days of summer. Things are sort of winding down, but there's just a ton of stuff. And even if you go beyond Milwaukee, you have other county fairs. You have the Kenosha County Fair. That's going on as well. Oconomowoc has a big festival of the arts. That's happening. And I don't know, just on and on and on. Plenty of stuff in August.
As you look over the lineup this summer, what are some of the events that you are most excited about?
I got really excited when Summerfest announced their big lineup because in years past, Summerfest releases, you know, these, you know, 8,000 names all at once. And it's just such a delightful mix of just different genres and different eras. And it makes no sense. And it's just, it's delightful. It was great to see Summerfest back, you know, announcing this very, very Summerfesty Summerfest lineup, which, you know, covers, like I said, everything from like classic rock to kind of 80s and 90s alternative rock to slightly more modern things. And then, you know, a couple of, you know, real modern day superstars in there as well. I've aged into the Summerfest demographic of all the bands that I want to see are playing at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday. So that's how old I am at this point, and I'm really embracing that. So I'm really looking forward to a day, I forget when it is exactly, but it's, you know, bands like the Melvins and the Breeders, and they're all playing in the middle of the afternoon, and what a treat for old folks like myself. So yeah, I'm always delighted by Summerfest, and I think it's one of their better lineups in a long time, you know, kind of forgetting the past few pandemic years, which were a little off and a little pared down. I think it's really strong, and they've got a lot of, you know, really interesting groups in there, and there's kind of stuff I want to see every single day. So looking forward to that for sure.
All right. Well, it promises to be a great summer to get back out into the community for some of us who have been staying inside the last couple of years. As always, Matt Wild, thank you for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you once again for having me.
Matt Wild is the co-founder of Milwaukee Record and a regular contributor to Lake Effect at WUWM.com. You can find more of our conversations with him. Coming up, we'll tell you about an exciting biology discovery made by a student at UW-Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last fall, two UW-Milwaukee students made an unexpected discovery at the university's field station in Ozaukee County. Joey Canizero and Morgan Schmansky discovered a four-toed salamander. The species is native to Wisconsin, but had never been documented in Ozaukee County. It's not endangered, but is under a cautionary special concern status. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz spoke with the students about their discovery. Canizero begins by describing the four-toed salamander.
This is a plethodontid salamander, so they are members of the lungless salamander family. They don't have lungs. They use their skin to breathe. Very tubular, very, very small animals. Very uncommon in parts of Wisconsin. You find them in sphagnum moss habitat in hardwood forest, which is what we have at the field station. Very, very pretty organisms. Very small. The adults are maybe 1 to 2 inches long, maybe half an inch wide. Very, very small creatures. They lay their eggs on land, and the females actually guard the eggs. They breed in the fall, and they lay their eggs in the springtime. But you find them, this was a novel record. They had never been reported in this county before. Very, very cryptic animals, very hard to find in general. So very lucky that we found them.
So Morgan, had you been out to the field station before you took that course?
I had not been to the field station before. The day that we found the four-toed for the Ozaukee County record, we were doing a beechwood forest survey, basically, and understanding how the beechwoods and the maples and so on and so forth. But we were just walking through the woods and, like Joey said, they're not common to be found above ground, let alone October 28th.
Yeah, in the fall. You really find them more in the spring.
In the fall. It was very mind-boggling. I saw a little bright white rock at an upturned tree that Gretchen was pointing at, and I was like, that rock is cool. So I go to pick up the rock because I'm also in a mineralogy course. I thought it was some other type of rock, but it's just a shirt. And had seen a tail of something, and another classmate was like, yeah, that's just a dead snake. And so I told Joey about it, and I was like, at lunch, I was like, Joey, I need your help. I don't know what it is. I think it might be a dead snake, but I'm not sure.
When you described it to me, you were like, maybe it's a salamander. And then you said that to me, my eyes perked up, because I said, well, what color is it? Because the most common here is a blue-spotted salamander, which are a really cool species in their own right, but very, very common in this habitat and region of the state. And you had said it was really small and maybe it was orange. And I was like, really? Let's find that if we can, because that sounds like something unique potentially.
So it was still in that spot when you returned?
Yeah, so our lunch was about a half an hour long. Yeah. And then Gretchen was like, we're going to go back out to the beechwood and the maple forest and see what we can see and learn about trees. And I was like, Joey, we have to look. And so Joey did a little bit of uncovering of the dirt to see what I had saw. Because I picked up the rock and put it in my pocket. I still have the rock today.
Cool rock.
It's pretty cool. Yeah. I showed him on the way here. But anyway, so he scooped up a little pile of dirt, and at first there was like nothing in it, and then he like brushed it off a little bit, and he was like, no way. And like I said, he was so excited about this tiny little being that I was excited, and then we had to like bring everybody over.
We ran to Gretchen and the class, and we said, we found a four-toed salamander.
Yeah.
And she was also excited too, which is
great.
She
was very excited. Yeah. We stopped class for our salamander break.
It was a tree day. I'm a herpetologist.
Yeah.
I'm a biologist. I'm a master's student in Guerlinda Herbals, Frog Behavior Lab, UW-Milwaukee. So I'm not very into trees like I am reptiles and amphibians. So it was great to take a break from trees for a day. They're important in and of their own right,
of course.
But yeah, Morgan likes trees. That's great. But
so,
we talked about salamanders.
So your interest in what creatures, was it frogs and salamanders that grabbed you as a kid?
Yeah. I mean, to this day, they still grab me. Yeah. I mean, you talk to most biologists, scientists, and stuff like that. It's, you know, a lot of us, it's a lifelong passion. I grew up in northeastern Illinois, the Chicagoland area, and I live by a river. And we, as a kid, go down and look for frogs and turtles and stuff like that. And it just became a lifelong passion.
Your find has been published.
It has. Yes. It's been published in the journal Herpetological Review. They keep track of geographic distributions, locations and counties where animals are found. Very important to map the locations of these animals, especially throughout time and things like that. So it has been documented. It was never reported before in this county. For our find. So this is a countywide find, especially at the Cedarburg Bog State Natural Area too.
Tell me more about the four-toed in Wisconsin. Yeah.
So that's a great question. So they're native to Wisconsin. Find them in kind of these remnant hardwood forests in contiguous regions, especially in the northern part of the state and the central part. My undergraduate, my alma mater was UW-Stevens Point, and you have a lot of really cool wildlife, including these ones up there. But you do find them. This was a range extension for them. So I think the closest known area was in the Kettle Moraine area, and we're right on the border of that, of course, you know, being within the tension zone of Wisconsin. But I think the closest area was in Sheboygan County, maybe something like 20 miles north, potentially. So this is definitely a range extension for them that we're aware of. So you find them in these really nice, intact hardwood forests. They have an abundance of sphagnum moss.
The moss is a factor.
Yeah, that's a very important, to our knowledge, very important component of their life history. So within their breeding, a lot of other salamanders in Wisconsin use ponds, ephemeral, so temporary pools to breed. These ones are part of them and one other species do not lay eggs in the water. They do lay their eggs in the water, this one, but they don't necessarily breed within there. So this is a land salamander. You find them breeding with other individuals, then they lay their eggs in sphagnum moss hummocks. So kind of these large mats of sphagnum moss overhanging bodies of water. And it's very interesting. Females will guard the eggs after they've laid them. You'll find them all curled around them, all snug, very cute. Then the eggs will hatch, and the little tadpole larva will hatch and fall into the water where they'll develop. So a very large part of their life history, a component important, is having that sphagnum moss.
And water.
Yeah, and water, yeah. Amphibians. Yeah, they're amphibians, exactly. Yeah, great point. there are habitats where you don't find sphagnum moss, and you actually do find them using wood and other things, but
that's
assumed to be pretty important to have that sphagnum moss for breeding.
Yes, but the one that we had found was definitely out of place for being in like detritus, leaf litter, and dirt. It might have been like on the way to hibernation, but we're not certain. So that's kind of like the mind-boggling aspect to be in a different unit in class, the forest unit, and we had passed our amphibian unit, which we found blue-spotted salamanders, but we had and a vole.
Yeah.
In our pitfall trap, which was kind of hilarious. Because we were in an amphibian unit and we found a mammal, and then we were in our tree unit and we found an amphibian. So I still think that's
nature for you,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Definitely, yeah. Nature.
So Morgan, you did that find, is that influencing what you're thinking about your next steps in your career?
I mean, I do think it's a deciding factor. I eventually do want to go back to school, maybe doing a master's program like Joey. Another good point that I've developed throughout my environmental career is only take photos and leave only footprints.
Yeah.
In the sense of nature being nature, mm-hmm. It's not ours, it's there. Just like when you find a spider in your house, it's your house, so you get rid of your spider. But we're out there, so there's gonna be a lot of spiders, snakes, salamanders, trees, rocks too.
Joey Cannizzaro is a graduate student in biology, and Morgan Schmansky is a conservation and environmental sciences student at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter, Susan Benz. You can see pictures of the four-toed salamander at WUWM.com. College can be a difficult transition for any student, and for students with autism, it can present even more challenges. Most students with autism require some extra support with their classwork, which can be difficult in standard programs. The Milwaukee Area Technical College, generally known as MATC, wanted to help students with autism navigate through college more easily. So they created the Uniquely Abled Academy, a program inside of the college specifically created with autistic students in mind. Terry Wezik is a machine tool instructor who works with the program, and Ethan Tutaj-Blaze is one of its students, working toward a degree in tool and die. They join me to share more. Tell me a bit about the Uniquely Abled Academy and how it's set up.
The Uniquely Abled Academy was set up to encourage a highly functioning autistic people to come in and get trained in our machine tool area as a starting point to help them be successful in the job field. The machine tool area is an area where they would be able to excel at, and we thought it was a great opportunity for the students to come in and give it a try.
When you say machine tool area, what does that entail? What kind of future careers come out of that kind of program?
Manufacturing based, it's machine shops that have CNC machines, computerized numerical controlled machines that some are semi-automated, learning the ins and the outs of how to set up and operate and run them, using all the precision measuring tools. Basically our workforce needs to have employable people that have these skill sets. And we're here doing the training that offers that. So in manufacturing, you could be manufacturing plastic injection parts. You could be machining aluminum parts or anything for automotive industry to food industry or even to surgical equipment stuff. So machining is a well-rounded career for people to start out as a basically being a machine operator, work themselves up to a lead man, a lead person, set up an operation, even CNC programming.
As you said, this program is geared toward what it describes as people with high-functioning autism. Why is this program a better fit for people than what might be your typical college course?
Well, it's the difference between a four-year degree and a two-year degree. Here at MATC, we pride ourselves on getting the students on hands-on. We take them to the shops. We get them manufacturing parts, usually within 2 to 3 days of being in the machine shop, on the machines, teaching the ins and outs. And we also have the related classes that go along with that, like the math and the blueprint reading and measuring tool metrology, stuff like that. So it's geared for them to get onto the machines and get some industry experience, manufacturing parts right away. Whereas a four-year degree, you have a lot more book work and less hands-on experience. That's in my personal opinion, of course.
One of the other things I would definitely say is that my peers who went through this program with me, one of the things is that they tended to need more time for information to be soaked up in order to understand why we're doing a certain procedure and how we're going to do it. So this program will provide them with more time to get that down.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense to me. Ethan, is that part of what attracted you to the program, or was it more about the jobs? Why did you decide to start with this program?
So I was working at COPS in the summer. I had originally planned to take a gap here. I didn't exactly know what kind of career I wanted to go in. School wasn't exactly my thing. I would have loved to be a particle physicist. That's a step beyond quantum physics. However, the thing is, I hate English classes. I wasn't the best when it came down to schoolwork. And going to trade school offered me much less of the classes I knew I would do much worse in. And it would make college much more tolerable. So when we heard about this program, I like working with my hands. I'm strong in math. It seemed like a great fit to kind of get into a field that I could get a job and not sit around at home all day.
Sure. When you think about the kind of coursework you've done at MATC, and this is really a question for both Ethan and Terry, how does it differ in your view from what you anticipated from a college course?
So I originally anticipated it to be much more like a traditional college where you get loads of homework, you have a certain amount of time to do that. It's way more expensive. So when we did this, I was shocked and I saw the price. It was really cheap, really affordable to do this program. And that was a big thing. Colleges, the prices are going up. Moving into this field, I had no idea what to expect either. I thought it was going to be like when you're welding, you have sparks flying everywhere. And I quickly found out that's not the case.
So I look at this program as a place where new students can enroll in this as career path. And it's where we mold them. If they make a mistake, I'd rather have them make it in a learning environment than when they get to a shop or a manufacturing facility and make mistakes. If we make mistakes, we learn from them, we move on. Hopefully we're teaching the proper habits and critical thinking to prevent the mistakes from being a continual habitual problem. Our manufacturing companies within our Milwaukee regional area, they appreciate that we go and take our time and thoroughly instruct the small things, the attention to detail, measuring devices, how to say the proper terms and talk in machine shop talk and information. It makes their transition from being a student to an employee very seamless. The industry really appreciates that we take the care and the time. And all of our instructors here at MATC have been in industry, so we know what to expect as what we're trying to send our students out to be.
Sure. Well, Terry, Ethan, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing a bit of what you do at MATC.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Terry Wezik is a machine tool instructor at MATC, and Ethan Tutaj-Blaze is a student at MATC working toward a degree in tool and die through the college's Uniquely Abled Academy. We spoke in March. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can always download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore the spike in violence we've seen in Milwaukee and what the Office of Violence Prevention is doing about it. Plus, we'll chat about locally owned pharmacies in the Milwaukee area. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.